Dr. F.A.C. Oles, Rule 4.
Well, of course, although we knew that these heads were on display, I didn't have the inclination to go and gawk at them, to look at them. But, you know, in a way it was quite reassuring for us to know that the Japanese were not taking, not allowing any lawlessness, no thievery, so it gave us a sense of safety in our homes against these elements. Now, as far as essential services are concerned, all the employees, past employees of the municipality, government organizations, and also and hospitals, were asked to report back to work. And they got going, and the respective local heads of their departments, those on the higher ranks of their departments took over. All are under control, of course, of the Japanese civil administration. The hospitals, they started functioning, but a number of them were taken over completely by the Japanese, and for example, the Singapore General Hospital was not made available to the civilians. Instead, the civilians had to use Kanang Krabau Hospital, which was called Chuoboyen, Byoen, Tan Tock Seng Hospital. So they slowly started the essential services going. I mean, it wasn't a rapid process as far as I can remember, but certainly it was a process that was started and people started reporting back to work. You ask how did the Japanese authorities communicate with the local people? There were proclamations. They used to print pamphlets and distribute them somehow. Of course, there were the newspapers that were started. They started off as a single sheet of paper, the Shonan Times, which later was called Shonan Shimbun. And then later on, the radio stations started functioning. But in order that we could use our radios at home, we first had to have them doctored. We had to send them to authorized radio dealers to have them fixed so that we could get no other station but the one from which the Japanese authorities are broadcast. Anybody caught with radios that could tune into London or elsewhere, or India or wherever, got into serious trouble. So there used to be these proclamations, these declarations, these orders that used to come over the radio, and pleasantly for us too, they said they were playing Western music, you know, Ben Miller and all that, and some Japanese songs, and Japanese songs are beautiful songs. Not entirely propaganda forced down your throat, but there, of course, there was that propaganda.
You mentioned earlier that there was a kind of registration for the first generation Eurasians, and they were given red tags. How did you get this news of registration?
I think this was... I cannot quite remember, you know, because I did not get a red tag. My father and mother did. My brother-in-law got one. But my brothers and I, we never did. My wife didn't. But I really don't know how it got about, but they eventually turned up with these tags. They might have been through the community. I think the leader of the Eurasian community was Dr. C.J. Pagla. It was through him that there were orders given to the Eurasian community from the Japanese to the Eurasian itself, to the Eurasian people. I cannot quite remember, quite honestly.
Do you remember where did you have to go to report yourself?
No, I'm afraid I can't remember that. But we did eventually got things like identity cards, and with these we were able to draw rations of rice every now and again. Details of these things, I'm sorry, I cannot recall.
Do you remember how you get the card for your rations? Was it during the meeting when you went to register yourself?
No, I don't think so. I think we were all told to go to the municipality, Tokubetsu-si, to get these cards, these sheets, these rations, these cards, whatever they were. I may be wrong, but I know we used to have to go there every now and again.
So, with this card, how did you go about getting your rations?
I think the grocers had supplied with rice, and you'd go there and they would provide you with your monthly supply. It wasn't great difficulty in getting it.
On a monthly basis?
Monthly basis, I reckon, yeah.
Do you remember the quantities of the rations?
No, I can't. But I can tell you this, they weren't enough. They were not enough. At least it was just token, I think, quantity. And we had to supplement rice with tapioca and anything we could get from the black market.
You mentioned earlier that you plant your own vegetables.
Yes.
And read your own poetry. So
that's right.
Were these used to supplement your diet?
They certainly did, but I was not self-sufficient by any means. And just across the way from us, there was a market gardener, and we used to get fresh vegetables from him. That he was useful.
Do you remember what were the items that were being rationed by the government?
Rice, for sure. And I think cigarettes, of all things. But those who didn't smoke black marketed their cigarettes. This is one of the greatest occupations of the Singaporean, was the black market trade. Everybody resorted to black market. Somehow I didn't, you know. I don't know why not, but people just did a lot of black marketing.
Did you know how to get contacts? For instance, if you want to buy something, so who would you approach to get goods from the black market?
The grocers would provide that, or then you see sometimes the neighbors would know where to get it from, and used to get something from the black market. Like my father-in-law, when he eventually had a car, he had to get petrol to move around, and he found out where to get black market petrol from. Black market also extended to things like medicines, which is sad. You could get, if you needed medicines, if you went to a pharmacy, you just couldn't find it, it was not available, but under the counter it was available. And also quite a number of medicines were produced, which were fakes. People were buying certain medicines, which was nothing else but tapioca flour, just faked up. You had these people doing that.
So all kinds of goods were available in the black market?
Yes.
How were the prices like compared to the goods that you could get from the counters?
Quite considerably higher. And way above our, many times, you know, in many cases, way above our means. So we just had to do without.
Could you remember some examples?
No. No, it's just that it was so way out that we just didn't consider getting them. I know that things like, eventually when we needed certain essential things like bicycles, we had to pay quite a considerable amount of money for bicycles. And somehow or other, bicycles were made available at bicycle shops, and we were able to buy those. Those were essential to take us around.
What about prices of those ration food?
Food that was rationed. Yes, that was within our reach. That was that we could afford. But I think if you had to buy that in the black market, you'd probably have to pay twice, three times what you paid for it, or if not more. I cannot quite remember. Honestly, I cannot remember.
So throughout the period of the Japanese occupation that you were in Singapore, did these prices fluctuate a lot?
Yes, of course. Yes, in the beginning we were using straight Singapore dollars, and then these were replaced by banana money, and the value of the Japanese dollars just slid so much, so that, I mean, what was you could buy for $1 soon after the war, you'd probably have to pay $1,000 just before the end of the war. It was just chaotic.
Dr. Liz, could you describe for us what yourself and your family members had for your meals compared with the pre-war times, the diet and the quantity?
Well, we tried to keep ourselves well fed, and we were lucky that we were able to survive well. We were able to get eggs for a start, for breakfast. We were able to get bread, not very good quality bread. We used to buy a loaf or so and then keep it until it's stale and toast it. Right down the road there was a factory selling tahu. And at 11 o'clock every day you find huge queues buying one or two cakes of tahu, which they sold to people as ration. That was a delicacy. Rice, we had to, couldn't have it all the time, every other day perhaps. The odd time we'd have chicken. Fish was very scarce, you know. Fish is very scarce. Things like, I suppose, mutton and beef, that also occasionally we had to walk down to Kanakrabau Hospital, KK Market, and buy some of that. Vegetables, but we used to dive into our canned foods, the corned beef, sardines and salmon, quite a bit. My mother-in-law was a very good cook, and she could turn out things out of, say, you know, the banana flowers. She used to make very nice, you know, vegetable with that. She used to make do. We eat things which we'd never used to eat before.
Besides the example of banana flowers, were there any other examples that you could think, the substitutes that she used for your normal food?
Tapioca was used quite a lot. Sweet potatoes. We used to grow our own kind of spinach, red spinach. We ate a lot of that. Kang Kong ate a lot of that. Outside of that, now, there were lots of restaurants cropped up, you know, cafes where we could go to and get food. Now, for example, you could get, say, bopia, but instead of using the ordinary rice wrapping, they would make it out of some tapioca, you know, and the stuffings would be a little bit different. You know, but they would still try to retain the flavor. And that, so that sort of food we wouldn't eat today, but we used to enjoy very much during the period. And simple things were quite popular. Pisang goreng. People used to come around selling pisang goreng. And for the people who used to love to drink the alcohol, you know, there was quite a number of brands of rice wine available to them. Different names. Namboku is one. And to replace the Johnny Walkers and the brandies and this. And the people, some of those who drank beer, for example, resorted to toddy and things like that. Cigarettes, those who smoke cigarettes got rations, but many of them rolled their own cigarettes, got cheap tobacco and made their own cigarettes. I remember I used to smoke at that time, and this is what I used to do. Foul-smelling cigarettes.
Did the food situation get worse in the later part of the time?
Oh, yes. It became more and more scarce. The black market became more and more difficult to get things that you wanted. Prices to go beyond the reach of the average person. And this is where Shinozaki and the Roman Catholic community stepped in. And Shinozaki had this dream of setting up a farming settlement and sending us all there to start a farming settlement to supply Singapore and Malaysia with vegetables, rice, and all other edibles. Things were getting a little bit difficult. But fresh fruit, there was that. We were in the tropics, so we could get fresh fruit. Even durians were available. Expensive, but available.
How was the condition in Singapore regards to health of the people, like during that time? Mm-hmm. What were the common diseases and illness then?
Health wasn't good at all of the general community. I think what conditions, what diseases were quite rampant were things like dysentery, bacillary dysentery, amoebic dysentery, skin diseases. You'd see people walking around with huge ulcers because of malnutrition. Malnutrition was a disease. And there were the cases, not too many cases of malaria in Singapore. And I think the hospital wards were filled with numbers of tuberculosis cases, all conditions which were related to lowered resistance. Lowered resistance brought about by difficult living conditions and insufficient food. Medicines were not easily available, and as I told you, a number of medicines that were issued were fakes, so they had no effect whatsoever.
Were there private doctors?
Yes, were private doctors. And one very popular private doctor was a Dr. Gauss. He's a Malay doctor in Middle Road who spoke Japanese fluently, who studied his medicine in Japan, and he was somehow, through his contacts, he was able to get the medicines. And he was, of course, he was well in with the Japanese, and he was one of the private practitioners. My father-in-law was a private practitioner too, but not for too long, because he was called to do work for the for the civil administration. But he was permitted to carry on with his private practice after office hours. But there were doctors in practice.
Was there freedom of movement in Singapore itself? Could you move about freely?
Oh yes, yes, we could move about freely, but on one condition. Every time you went past a guard, you have to bow low to him and then go off. You didn't bow, he'd knock you on the head. And that was, I mean, if you're on a bicycle and you pass a sentry, you just get off your bicycle, bow, and off you go. That is the only stipulation. Otherwise you could go score anywhere.
Was the sentry posted there all the time until you left Singapore?
Yes. Yeah, there were certain vantage points. Bridges, in town. Yeah, there were sentries all over. And there was also one place where you had, in Kampong Java Road, there was a body of a Japanese who was shot by whilst he was walking along that road, and he was buried on the spot. And that was a shrine. You had to stop at that shrine and bow to it, you know. But if you did these things, okay, you could go around.
Did you know whether you could travel freely between Malaya and Singapore at that time?
No, I think you had to have special passes to move around. I know that we lost communication with my brother and his family, who were in Penang. They were in Penang when Penang was taken, and they remained there. He was a doctor for the entire duration, and we hardly had any contact with him.
Within Singapore itself, do you need any kind of pass to move about?
Well, I think you could be issued with identity cards. They weren't cards as we know have them now, but it's just a little bit of paper. And our names written in katakana.
Was it given to everyone or just the Eurasian community?
No, I believe everybody. Well, this is my memory. This is as far as I can remember, you know. I know I had one, because I know how my name was so funny. It was pronounced Orasu.
Did you have to carry it with you all the time?
Yes, just for safety's sake, yes.
Besides bicycles and a few cars that were available, were there any kind of public transport?
There were trolley buses and buses.
How
they were
the
put
conditions
on the streets.
Like of this?
Well, they were all jam-packed. Rickshaws. Rickshaws had been had given way to trishaws. And I think trishaws were invented during that time, you know. These trishaws, as we know, with the sidecars. Originally, the trishaws were with the seats in front and the rider behind. And during this, occupation, somebody designed the sidecar trishaw, and they became very popular. And that became the most popular means of transport. And also, you've got these entrepreneurs, people with some money, who used to buy, who used to order large quantities and rent these trishaws out.
Were these run by the Japanese?
No. Individual, private concerns. Individuals used to do that. And even, I know of one Eurasian man who had a very high position in a company. To earn his living, he became a trishaw man. Eventually he went to Bahau, and there, unfortunately, he died. This, the trishaws as we see them now with other tourists, those were invented during the Japanese occupation.
What about recreation during that time?
Recreation throughout the Japanese occupation, I think people started playing their games again, like soccer, hockey, and badminton, and so on. Tennis, of course, is out of the way, but you know, because all the tennis courts were ruined. and home recreation, things like mahjong, cards, and if you're a musician, you played your songs, your music. And what was very nice, what we liked very much, were the Japanese songs that we got to know. Very, very nice melodies. They even played today, these old Japanese classics or semi-classics. Outside of that, it was not. I mean, we didn't go to beaches, for example. We weren't allowed. I don't think we were allowed to go there. They were all being manned by the Japanese military.
Any kind of entertainment, like the cinema?
Yes, there was cinema. Of course, all of it was censored. Japanese films, Malay films. Were they Western films? I cannot remember. I don't think. We didn't used to go. Recreation also, that time too, food. Hawkers going, you know, they could go and get buy food. I mean, Rex Cinema, there were the hawker stalls there.
Were these hawker stalls very rampant?
Yeah. Yes, they were. They were selling food. Now, like say, you know, like kway teow, for example, I remember. It wasn't anything like the kway teow, it was fine, coarse stuff. Very coarse kway teow. But we had it, enjoyed it, thoroughly enjoyed it. Any other question you want to ask me?
Do you know what kind of Japanese propaganda was on during that time? For instance, did they try to encourage you to appreciate more Japanese music or learn more about their language or culture?
Oh yes, they encouraged us to learn their language and sing their national anthem. And it was useful for us to learn their language, very useful. I mean, you know...